Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Today's global climate strikes have been massive. I think it's fair to say that they have already exceeded expectations. Early numbers say 400,000 people turned out across Australia, 100,000 in Berlin, 100,000 in London, 1.4 million in Germany. We've also seen strikes in Tokyo, India, South Africa, Uganda, Brazil, Thailand, and Pakistan. And as of now, about 10 o'clock Pacific time, strikes are getting underway in San Francisco and across California and the West Coast. So strikes began on the East Coast this morning. They're expected to continue to Hawaii. The walkout is expected to be so widespread that New York City public schools told students that they would not be penalized for missing class today. Just over a year ago, Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg started striking on Fridays outside the Swedish parliament demanding government action. And that Friday strike has turned into a global movement. According to the Global Climate Strike website, over 4,000 events are scheduled this week in 156 countries on all seven continents. The strike is part of a week of actions coinciding with the UN Climate Action Summit, which starts on Monday, and world leaders are expected to talk about how to keep global temperatures from rising 2 degrees Celsius. This week has been an incredible week of media coverage. Since Monday, more than 300 media outlets have been taking part in a week-long project called Covering Climate Now. It's an effort not just to cover the citizen and government actions taking place, but to collaborate and increase the visibility of the climate crisis in the media. And we have been covering this all week. We cover the climate crisis every Monday. Joining us to talk about coverage of all of these issues are three guests. Kyle Pope is editor-in-chief and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. CJR, The Guardian, and The Nation magazine are spearheading the Covering Climate Now project. Hi, Kyle. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Allegra Kirkland, senior politics editor for Teen Vogue magazine. This week, Allegra wrote a piece looking at what climate change will do to three major cities by 2100, San Francisco, St. Louis, and Houston. Hi, Allegra. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. I'm so glad to be here.
It's great to have you. Taylor Kate Brown writes for the San Francisco Chronicle and edits their newsletter. She used to work for the BBC, and Taylor joins us in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So as we always do on our media roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. Kyle, I've been looking at the list that you all send out every day, and it's just incredible. There's so many stories on such a wide range of issues. So I'm sure it's going to be hard for you to just choose one or even two stories that stood out.
Yeah, I mean, we have been sort of astonished by the response to this and how people, I mean, what's happened is people did exactly what we hoped they would do, which was like find the stories that we certainly don't know what's going on in their communities, but find the stories that matter to them. I mean, we've, as you mentioned, we have about 300 partners now who are contributing stories representing an audience of about a billion people. So it's really hard to sort of pick. But the range, I think, is just worth noting. I mean, we have the Asahi Shimbun writing a story about how global warming is making it really hard to prepare for athletes coming to the Tokyo Olympics. Mm. We have a story about what rising temperatures in the Gulf of Maine mean for the lobster industry. We have I love this piece. The National Catholic Reporter wrote a story with the headline, "Would Pope Francis Back the Green New Deal?" It's a little bit, we don't quite know the answer, but, and then there are Yale Climate Connections, which is associated with the university, did a piece about how extreme weather is threatening people with disabilities.
Oh, wow.
So it's just this incredible breadth of work that we're just thrilled about.
And people can find all of those stories on the website Covering Climate Now or on social media. What about you, Taylor? You have been closely following all of the coverage that's come out this week. What stands out for you?
Yeah, so I actually want to sort of step away from the what's there's a ton of stuff on that hashtag, especially on Twitter, covering climate now. And at the Chronicle, we've done at least one story a day. That is sort of a major A1 story about how climate is affecting the Bay Area specifically. But something that struck me just this morning was a New York Times style section piece, which isn't part of this, but I think speaks to some of the both how young people are affecting change in just how the structure of the world works and how working remotely could help lower carbon emissions. It's a style story about how Gen Z and millennials are pushing for more flexibility in the workspace. And it's something that I think you realize that climate touches everything, right? And if you are not commuting 2 hours each day, each way, and that's a real thing here in the Bay Area, that is one less car on the road. If you're carpooling, if you come in on certain times, or I'm just saying, it's like, to me, that's also a climate story, even though it's not under the hashtag. And I thought it was a really good, although a little bit slightly pushed towards office work rather than maybe somebody on a shift schedule. Obviously, they can't have that kind of flexibility. I think it speaks to how you could imagine a lot of stories as climate stories.
Well, we'll link to that piece at yourcallradio.org. What about you, Allegra? What stood out for you this week?
Well, I know we're going to talk about Team Rogue's coverage at length later, so I won't get too promotional just yet. But there was a piece from my former Talking Points Memo colleague, Josh Kavensky, about how white nationalists are using climate change as sort of like a scare tactic to sort of, you know, talk about, you know, being this looming resource battle. And so, you know, people should just be sort of opposed to immigration and we should build the wall because, you know, there's only going to be this limited amount of resources for everyone to share. And I just thought that was like a very striking piece. And it's, you know, interesting that these white nationalists are taking the science more seriously than, you know, a lot of people in our own government, even if it's for a sort of twisted reason. So,
wow. And where did you see that piece?
I was in Talking Points Memo, my old workplace. So.
Okay. All right. Well, we will. Wow. We'll definitely link to that one. Thank you so much. So, Kyle, let's start off by talking. We're going to talk about covering climate now, but because the strikes have been just so massive, and we're going to see them across the United States today as the day unfolds, what are your thoughts on just the sheer numbers here, the fact that they're led by youth, and what do you think of the coverage of this incredible youth movement so far?
I credit this youth movement with so much of the renewed attention on this story, and including the media attention. I think the press has been a bit slow to catch on. I mean, really since for the last few months, there's been a fair amount of attention, especially on Greta, which you mentioned in your opening. But I think, there's been a lot building here that I think a lot of news outlets just didn't really sort of capture. Mm-hmm. And that's because, that sort of is part of the bigger problem, which is that there is real energy out there that has not been captured by a lot of big media outlets because they just haven't been paying attention. But I definitely think it's there. I mean, frankly, I'm not that surprised by the numbers. I thought they would be astonishing, and indeed they are astonishing. I mean, and this is what's so interesting about, when you think about, and one of the exercises that we went through as we were trying to put together this collaboration was, talking to media outlets about why they're not doing more climate coverage. And the response was always like, oh, it's depressing, people will tune it out, like, oh, we're not sure people want to hear it. And my response was always like, well, really? Because that is not the response that young people have. Mm-hmm. Like, young people, they have a lot of responses to this. They get angry, they get energized. But one of the responses is not that they tune it out. So I think there was this kind of sort of out of sync thinking on the part of a lot of big media organizations about what the audience for this was about.
And I also think it's important to point out that media comprises so many different things.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the independent media has been doing a really great job. And I know you Taylor, you follow climate journalists on Twitter who cover these issues 24/7. I mean, that is their beat. So when we criticize media, we're really talking in many cases about the cable shows. They don't really go very deep into these issues. They don't make connections often between like Dorian and climate change, or at least to bring a scientist on and say, well, tell us about the connections and tell us what we don't know yet. So there's different layers to this when we talk about media.
Yeah.
Just if I can jump in real quick,
sure.
There, because we've gotten some pushback on people saying like, oh, you're painting all the media with the same brush and saying everybody's doing a bad job, which we haven't been. What we have been saying, though, is the media where most people get their information, which is television,
right,
both national and local, that's where the problem is. So that means we have a media problem.
Right.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I generally agree with that because, you know, even in local markets, we know that here in San Francisco, like, local TV is a big thing. Newspaper is also a big thing, but local television is where most people get their day-to-day news that affects their local, you know, environment, to be quite literal about it. But the thing that I noticed, because this is something that I've had an interest in for a long time, that the people who are covering climate journalism are most... This is a week that feels very much like every other week to them. And I think the importance of what we're doing this week is putting it back into the day-to-day news cycle, because there's a lot of other stuff that's going on. In San Francisco, homelessness is a huge issue. Housing crisis is a huge issue. And I could go on, and these are all what one of my colleagues calls front burner issues. They're in some ways all connected back to climate change, and they affect climate change. But when you have something that is right in your backyard and it's showing up in your backyard, you tend to think about it more and think about solutions to it more. And one of the things that we've done in the past at the Chronicle is the Homeless Project. And we did something very similar for 4 years now, for 1 week or one day, whatever happened to be, just flood everything with stories about homelessness and the solutions to them.
Right. What are your thoughts on this, Allegra?
Yeah, and I wanted to jump off what that last comment and say, I think in terms of the mainstream, like, big media outlets, I think something that's changed over the last few years is, you know, we're kind of seeing the effects of climate change now in the United States. It's not something that's just, like, happening over there. It's like Maria and Harvey and Florence and the wildfires in California, I think, really made it feel more real to people and made bigger outlets feel like this was something that, you know, they should be covering more intensely. And then, I mean, for us, like, teen Vogue readers have always cared about climate change, and we've always, that's always been one of, like, our sort of, you know, for the past couple of years, been one of our major areas. And I think that's because, you know, our readers are this younger generation who's going to be there to live through, you know, the effects of extreme, like, carbon emissions and rising seas and all of that. So, yeah, I think it's generational. And I think a lot of, you know, big corporate media outlets are run by older people who might not see it as much of a threat. There was that really interesting CBS poll out Monday that was part of this project. You could see the split, even, you know, it's a bipartisan issue for young people. It said it was something like 70% of people between 18 and 29 think it's a serious problem or a crisis, and only 58% of people over 65 agree. So, you know, So it's definitely a core issue for Teen Vogue and our readers.
And you worked on a piece looking at what the Bay Area might look like with decade-by-decade predictions. You partnered with Nexus Media to gather data. And to summarize, you wrote that San Francisco will witness rising sea levels, fierce wildfires, and extreme droughts. The predictions presume an average sea level rise of about 6 feet by 2100. So tell us about this project.
Yeah, so when we first sat down to kind of think about what stories you'd want to tell our readers, just a timeline was one of the first things we thought of, because I think it helps show, you know, starting in 2020 makes, you know, people just very aware of what's going on already right now. And, you know, and we're not talking about the distant future. We're talking about, you know, you know, when people are like 40, 50 years old, if they want to have kids, that sort of thing, just being able to sort of map it out. And we also wanted to choose just three specific locations, and we chose St. Louis, Houston, and San Francisco, because we wanted places that have, you know, are going to have different, be affected by different, you know, parts of climate change, so like wildfires versus drought versus rising seas, because I think it just sort of helps people picture it if it's this one specific place versus, you know, what's going to happen to North America. And so the team at Nexus Media was amazing. They, you know, compiled tons of research and talked to a dozen climate scientists and just helped us put together this whole project. And I think it's just, the details are really jarring. And, you know, I think there's also this interesting divide for us and for people covering climate change. You know, do you sort of go apocalyptic and scare people into action, or do you offer practical solutions? And we try to do both. So, you know, this piece was a little bit more like the scaring side, but we also do a lot of coverage that's like, you know, how to take action climate crisis at your school this year and explainers and that sort of thing. So it's not all just be scared if, you know, this is happening. It's just how can you, you know, take action.
Right. What response did you get to this particular project?
We've gotten a great response to that and all our coverage this week, yeah.
What are your thoughts about that, Kyle? I mean, I find, especially this week, we've been talking about air pollution. We talked about the food supply, what the science tells us. And it's such an interesting time because there's so much information out. I mean, the piece we did about the world's food supply from the World Resource Institute, this is a 550-page report that is full of what we're dealing with and then so many solutions. And so we have access to all of this information and we know what we need to do. But at the same time, like that piece that came out yesterday in the New York Times about how many birds we've lost over the last 50 years. It's just such an interesting time where we have information and we have all these people on the streets and yet so much damage has already been done. So what are your thoughts about, as journalists, how to bring all of these aspects into stories?
Yeah, it's a really interesting debate. I mean, it was sort of galvanized by this piece that Jonathan Franzen wrote in the New Yorker, whatever it was, a week or so ago, and in which he sort of captured this idea that, you know, basically it's all so terrible and we're all so doomed, so why bother? And he got a lot of hit back on that, which I think was justified. But I do think it's a challenge. I mean, that bird story really stood out to me. It's one of those, you read a lot of these kind of pieces, but the numbers are just so stark. And the sort of, the kind of minutia of it is so awful. I mean, it's like, you know, it's not like robins are going extinct, but there's billions fewer of these birds. So I think what Allegra said is exactly the right approach to this, which I think you have to sort of make people very aware of the severity of the problem and of the urgency of the problem. I mean, the good news is that the scientists have basically been working on this now for decades and decades, and they've been waiting for the press to show up. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've actually talked to scientists. I mean, they've been hiring like media coaching experts now for years, and they were like, all of our people are ready, but no one's calling. So finally, now we're getting, the press is starting to be interested. There's a ton, as this week has shown, there's basically whatever you want to know about in terms of the effect of climate on it, the data is there. Somebody has done this work. So it's just a matter of plugging in. I don't know. I think that there's, I mean, I think the way to really make this resonate is just to bring it down as close to the local level as you can get. Like, what does it mean for my reservoir in my town that's going to affect whether the people in my community can go fishing? Mm-hmm. What is it going to mean for, you know, the high school football team who can't practice in pads in August anymore because it's too hot? And those are the stories, I think, that are finally going to get people across the sort of political spectrum, just kind of wake up and say, this is something that's happening here and we have to respond. But the data is all there. And again, like, I think we assume that giving people factual scientific based information is a downer. I think that is a mistake. I think a lot of people hear this and they don't view it as a downer. They just say, that's outrageous. What are we going to do about it?
Right. Well, and I just want to mention, in case people have not read the bird story, we're talking about a piece in the New York Times that ran yesterday. Birds are vanishing from North America. The number of birds in the United States and Canada has declined by 3 billion, or 29%. Over the past half century, according to scientists. And NPR reported this morning, they talked to one of the scientists who said, if you had to summarize why this is happening, it's because of urban growth and agriculture. So if you get a chance, check out that story. What are your thoughts, Taylor, about what Kyle said about the importance of local coverage?
Yeah.
Because that's where so much of this happens.
Right. I think people see big stories in national press, and they're exceptionally well done, and they have all the data and all the science, and, you know, they've found a single person to, like, try to share that narrative. And as a journalist, I look at that and I'm like, wow, that was beautifully done. But if you're a civilian, you just get to the end of it and say, okay, what does that mean to me, and what can I do about it? Right? It's that sort of, that was beautiful, but oh God. So I think when we talk about local coverage, it's really important to build it into everywhere, build in climate change to wherever it's going to make sense to build it into. When we do a housing story, just today, J.K. Janine did a story in our paper about sprawl and this new development that is past the Altamont Pass, which, if you're not from the San Francisco area, is a ginormous distance from San Francisco, and people are commuting from there, and it's because it's a housing crisis.
How many hours is that? Is it two?
God, I don't know, so I'm not going to say.
Okay.
But it's far.
A long ways away.
It's far, and it's a lot of traffic.
Yeah.
And so that is a absolutely personal issue for everyone, but people move out there because they want to be able to afford a home. And that has implications on both sides of both solutions and contributing to the climate. Another thing that is super important to people is, I mean, not necessarily what's going to happen to me, although we did get some of that. It was, we asked our readers for questions. It was, what's going to happen to my community? And that's either from my neighborhood, from the town I live in, from, you know, I am a wine grower, and that is also a community. And so those both geographical and other communities, that it's at that level that people really care about. And the one thing that we got here, and I think is, you know, real specific to San Francisco, is sea level rise. And we're centered around a huge body of water. The region is, you know, part of it. You can't avoid it. And people want to know, where is it going to be? And we tried our best to show exactly where that's going to be.
A few predictions from Allegra's story. By 2040, sea levels are predicted to rise around 1 foot in San Francisco and the Bay Area, enough to encroach the beaches on the west side of the city and Candlestick Point on the east. Part of San Francisco Airport and Oakland Airport will flood regularly, making air travel in and out of the city even more difficult. This is by 2040. And you can find that story at yourcallradio.org. I know the Chronicle has also done a lot of coverage on sea level rise, along with SF Public Press. I mean, the information is out there. There's just so much great reporting out there. And today we are talking about the climate strikes and this incredible initiative covering climate now. And we're joined by Kyle Pope, editor-in-chief and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. Allegra Kirkland is senior politics editor for Teen Vogue magazine. And Taylor Kate Brown writes for the San Francisco Chronicle, where she edits their newsletter. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW, a program that's better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, a further roundup of the week's news with the Friday Media Roundtable on 1A from WAMU in Washington. Stay with us.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about media coverage of the massive strikes happening across the country and the world. We're also talking about the initiative Covering Climate Now. More than 300 media outlets have been taking part in this project all week. And if you have a question or a comment about the media coverage that you are seeing, when you read massive stories about climate change, whether it's at the international level, national, or local, what really grabs you? What are your thoughts about how far we have come? I mean, again, there are many different layers to this. There's the independent media and then, of course, the corporate TV media. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's go to Brad in San Francisco. Hi, Brad. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Sorry, I have a bit of a cough.
That's okay.
So I would like to see someone address the issue. I was going to say that the people who are being actively out in the street attempting to make changes appear to be younger and younger. We started out 100 years ago with a generation more in their early 30s, late 20s, moved slowly down the scale to college-age students from 18 to 22, and as a core essence, we moved down to the high school, and now we're moving down to junior high. So I think there's a theme there, although I will add that there's a lot of geriatrics out there, a fair amount as well. But why is this getting to the point where the only people who are actually concerned to try to take an active role out in the streets are so young?
Well, to that point, I hope you can take some time over the weekend. A number of youth testified on Capitol Hill, I believe it was on Thursday, and it was just striking to see these young people, in many cases, educating politicians about the science. Republicans really didn't ask the kids any questions. They talked about their love of capitalism, which was kind of surreal to watch them say those things in front of youth. But what are your thoughts on this, Kyle? What really strikes you about just how young these kids are? I mean, they're kids, and they know the science so well. I mean, when Greta Thunberg was on The Daily Show, I think she spent about 3 minutes really explaining the science.
Yeah. Well, the first point, though, is while these young people have been sort of leaders of the movement, if you look at the social media photos and videos that are coming out of today's actions around the world, it is an incredibly broad group of people. If you spend a second with this, it's young people, it's old people, it's everybody in between. So I think the actual representation on the streets today is much broader than the activists that we've seen. But I think that ultimately what we're talking about is something that somebody already said, which is I think there is a generational gap here where I think There has been, those of us who are not young sort of had baked a lot of, there has been this sense baked in for a long time that climate coverage, I'm talking about now really about the media part of it, but that climate coverage does somehow equal activism. And I think that that's an incredibly flawed idea. I mean, I think if you look back on the history of journalism and some of the great moments in journalism history, whether it's coverage of civil rights or Vietnam or Watergate or whatever, these are incredibly important things where journalists recognized a wrong in the world and set about fixing it. And we don't look back on those moments now and say, well, that was activism. We just say that was great journalism. But I think it's, I still think that there is that sort of thing to overcome with older journalists and people of an older generation in general, and these younger kids just don't have any of that. They don't have any of that sort of baggage and any of that sense that there's anything other than an enormous story and an enormous sense that something is wrong and has to be fixed.
Kyle, you co-authored a piece on CJR's website describing some roadblocks in the way of deep, continuous coverage of the climate crisis. And This really stood out for us. You wrote, one of our most sobering conversations came during a meeting inside of one of the world's biggest news organizations with a group of people asked by their boss to improve their climate coverage. These people were eager to embrace our project and had the resources to do it, but they had no idea how to begin. Where do we come up with story ideas? Who should our sources be? Can you help us think this through? You write, their response stunned us given the size of the newsroom around us, but it reminded us early on in this process that in many cases we're starting from scratch. Now, I don't mean to toot our own horn here, but we have a staff of three on this show, and we have been covering the climate crisis every Monday. We had so many ideas for this week. I mean, it was hard to nail it down to five. We've got enough stories to talk about for the next, you know, 5 years every Monday. I mean, not obviously we're not going to ask you what organization this was, but it's really hard to wrap your head around this.
Yeah. No, we walked out of there. It was with my colleague, Mark Hertzgard from The Nation, who is my partner on this project. We both walked out of there saying, I do not believe what we just heard. And we actually sent them in the days that we sent them a list of story ideas. We're like, here's five story ideas. and to the point that we were just talking about, it is worth noting, and again, it's not a ding or whatever, it's just the facts, that everybody in that room from their side was over 40. And that may be why they were having problems sort of conceiving of this. So it was really striking, and it was actually a good conversation to have for us early on in this process, because we had sort of assumed that people knew what to do, but there were other things that were blocking them. There were political issues, there was management issues, and I think those things do exist, but it also sort of like reinforced to us that, you know, there's a lot of people that are just, they don't know where to start. Now, I'm just stating that fact isn't the same as forgiving them for being in this spot, because it's sort of unforgivable, frankly. But it's where they are, and it's where we found them. So that's what we had to deal with.
So I know that a number of media outlets joined covering Climate Now after it launched because it was so massive. So this media outlet that you met with, have they been covering the climate this week?
They have been.
Okay.
And quite well, actually.
Good. Well, I want to call you after the show to find out which outlet this was. I'm very curious. Taylor, at Teen Vogue, can you talk about what conversations you all have about what to cover?
Sure, I'm happy to. So in terms of how we cover climate change specifically, as I said, like, readers already care about the issue deeply. It's something very near and dear to them. So we see ourselves in, you know, as a platform for young people's voices. So we run a lot of, you know, op-eds from Zero Hour and Sunrise activists about the work they're doing, or about, like, why isn't there a climate debate, or about, you know, the policies they're interested in. We had Greta on our cover this week for a special issue. My co-politics editor, Lucy Diavolo, got to interview her, so that was a really cool thing to get. And then, yeah, we also have a lot of teen reporters who, like, today we had a piece that was, like, a couple weeks in the making. Our 19-year-old reporter, Sarah Emily Baum, was sort of going to the planning meetings of the organizers of the youth climate strike here in New York City, and sort of getting the inside details and, like, how they put this massive event together. So really just, like, letting young people represent themselves, because I think they're so underrepresented or misrepresented in the media a lot. And then beyond that, we also want to serve as a resource for readers, like I mentioned, sort of provide them with practical information, like explainers on how, say, like, migration and climate change are connected, or, you know, the labor implications of climate change, that sort of thing. But yeah, just being sort of meeting them on their level and taking them seriously as readers and activists and informed young people who are aware of the implications of this crisis.
And I'm sorry, I meant Allegra.
My
desk is full of papers today, but Allegra. I also just want to mention, Allegra, for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with Teen Vogue, over the last couple of years, you have all done really incredible reporting on a range of topics, from the climate crisis to race, immigration, gender, identity.
Yeah, well, so I only came on board in July, so I can't take credit for any of that. But yeah, I think You know, I mean, basically what Teen Vogue sort of realized at this stage is that we want to, you know, focus on what's going on in the world and how it's impacting young people. And I think young people have just become a lot more politically engaged over the last couple of years. I think part of this is Trump's election. I think it's seeing the climate crisis get more serious. I think it's, you know, just people becoming more comfortable talking about, I mean, like the Me Too movement. Like, I think people are just talking about those issues, and young people are too, and we want to, you know, cover that on their behalf.
Yeah, and just to give you a sense of what else they cover, they featured an op-ed from an 18-year-old from St. Croix on her firsthand experience dealing with sea level rise, and then there's a new piece out detailing how youth climate activists organized the New York City strike. And you can find information about this at yourcallradio.org. And Taylor, you mentioned that you got a number of questions about the climate crisis. Now, the Chronicle readers tend to skew a little bit older.
Sure.
Obviously, compared to Teen Vogue.
Yeah, absolutely,
you,
Teen Vogue.
You mentioned what stood out for you just in terms of people really wanting more information about what's happening in their own communities. What other questions did you get?
Yeah, so basically what we did is that we put on our website, and we referred to it in our print edition, a form that you could submit questions to us directly, and our promise was to answer as many Bay Area-related ones as we possibly could. And what we got from that was, a lot of sea level rise, a lot of questions about that, both in the general sense and in, like, what's happening to my backyard. Excuse me. And we got a lot of questions about the environment and, like, what people could do about it. I meant the local environment. But what we got out of that is that there is a lot of interest, right? We got a ton of questions, almost as many as we got out of the homeless. We did the same thing for homelessness. And so there's interest there. And one of the things that I've only been with the Chronicle for a year, but one of the things I'm very proud about is that we have been covering climate throughout that time. It's not heavily as concentrated as it was this week, but our wine writer, Esther Mobley, actually had this really great story about what Napa wineries are doing to try to adjust to temperature increases. Curtis Alexander, one of our reporters, had a story on the threat more intense wildfires from climate change make on these giant sequoia, like 1,000-year-old trees. So it's there in our coverage. This week is special, but I think if you can build it into your daily work, especially in a daily newspaper where we have really, like, very specific deadlines to hit, as if it's part of the background, it becomes more forceful rather than, you know, a special week can get a lot of attention. But you're talking about the processes of, like, how you make change, what the details are in your local environment. That needs sustained attention.
Right. And from here on out, Kyle, with covering climate now, what is next for this project now that so many media outlets have signed on?
Well, the point that was just made about how it's not about this week, really. It's about, like, figuring out how the newsrooms can change how they function. That's the point of this whole project, really. I mean, the reason we focused on this 1 week was, one, we thought if we went to newsrooms and said, you need to do better about your climate coverage in general, what are you going to do? They would sort of shrug their arms and say, well, we don't know where to start, and we'll try to do better, and we wouldn't hear anything else from them. So we thought, let's contain it and make it manageable. But then, so what we're doing after this week is going back to all these places and saying, what did you learn? What do you need? Did you learn anything about who in the newsroom is interested in this? Did you learn anything about how you can sort of restructure your beats? Did you figure out that we're really interested in this, but we don't quite have access to the right people, and can we help you get you that access to whoever it is that you need to talk to? So it really is about, you know, one, giving people a taste. I mean, because it'll be really interesting, and obviously we don't have this data yet, but a lot of these news organizations will, to look at what the readership was. So we did this for a week, and, like, what was the response? Mm-hmm. And anecdotally, what we hear from people, and it's been mentioned here already, you know, by the two news organizations that are doing this here, is that people respond to this, and they read these stories. Mm-hmm. So what we're hoping is that they'll hear that from readers, they'll learn that there are people in the newsroom who are really into this and really think it's important. And finally, there's going to be real power in just kind of modeling behavior. I mean, what we're going to do is put on our website all of these stories that ran this week. I mean, there's going to be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. So if you're a small, you know, newsroom somewhere and you're like, well, we tried, but we don't know what we did, you can look at how other small newsrooms did and what they did, and you can steal those ideas. So I think that has a lot of power. And so that's sort of how we're thinking about moving forward.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us. And you can find all of this work at yourcallradio.org. Kyle Pope is editor-in-chief and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. CJR, The Guardian, and The Nation magazine are spearheading the Covering Climate Now project. Thank you so much, Kyle.
Thank you.
Allegra Kirkland is senior politics editor for Teen Vogue magazine. Thank you for joining us, Allegra.
Thanks for having me.
And Taylor Kate Brown writes for the San Francisco Chronicle, where she edits their newsletter. Taylor, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you. And coming up after a short break, we will be joined by Mike Elk, who is a labor reporter for The Guardian and Payday Report. He is on the ground in Michigan, where he has been covering the GM auto strike all week. We'll be back after this.
Coming up later today at 1 on KLW, it's Latino USA. This week, Marina Hinojosa sits down with Senator Bernie Sanders to talk about his decision to run for the presidency again, growing up in a working-class family, and his ideas on immigration. Latino USA at 1 today.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're going to switch gears now and talk about the GM strike. On Monday, up to 50,000 hourly employees walked off the job after contract negotiations broke down. And joining us to talk about this is Mike Elk. He's a labor reporter for The Guardian and Payday Report. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be with you here from Spring Hill, Tennessee, where GM workers are on strike.
Oh, you're in Spring Hill, Tennessee. Great. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike. And before we dive in and talk about the strike and the media coverage, I just want to put out some basic facts. According to the Detroit Free Press, General Motors reported its overall revenue of $36 billion. This just came out in August. So we're talking about a company with $36 billion in revenue. The Detroit Free Press also has a piece about General Motors CEO Mary Barra. Her 2018 compensation was almost $22 million. She's one of the 20 highest paid CEOs in the country. And she brings home about 281 times as much as GM's median employee's compensation of about $77,000. So do you have anything to add on those two facts, Mike?
Well, I think what's interesting is that while GM's profits are increasing, they're asking for concessions from their workers. Real wages have fallen by 16% since 2010 at General Motors. As a result of inflation and wage, you know, increases not keeping up with inflation. Additionally, GM is asking workers to pay more for their health care. At the same time, GM is also increasingly bringing in temporary workers that start at $14 an hour and don't have any health insurance benefits. So it's diluting the power of the union. And while all of this is going on, GM is increasingly closing facilities in the U.S. and opening new ones overseas. So there's a lot of anger here that, you know, GM, which nearly went bankrupt 2008-2009, that needed a $50 billion bailout as well as massive concessions from the union in order to stay afloat, is now, demanding workers make concessions despite GM being profitable again.
Hmm. Can you talk about the decision to go on strike? I mean, almost 50,000 workers, and it's been a week so far. This is a major strike for these workers.
This is a huge drag, and obviously, you know, these decisions weren't made lightly. You know, there's a feeling that, you know, with General Motors, something has to give. Right now, the UAW is in contract talks with the big three. So, you know, they're targeting General Motors first. They're going to try to get an agreement at General Motors. Then they're going to go after Chrysler, and they're going to go after Ford. So this is the beginning of a pattern of action by the UAW. And this comes at an interesting time in the history of the union. Five top UAW officials have been convicted of taking bribes from companies in exchange for concessions at the bargaining table. And this has really hurt the union's reputation, particularly in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where the union lost an election there by only 29 votes last year. Last June. And as a result of it, you know, it's really interesting because, you know, the remaining UAW leadership is still taking on the company now. And so this could be a shift in terms of the militancy of that union. And it also comes just a year after massive teacher strikes saw mass support. So it's really quite interesting, particularly in the social media age. You know, this is the first time there's been a GM strike in the social media age. So this is just a really fascinating period. It's a turning point in the union. It could be a turning point for workers nationwide.
You have interviewed a number of workers on the ground there. One worker, Lynn Howard Watson, she's a 41-year GM veteran. 41 years for this company, and she says that the union is prepared for a strike that could last a month. She said, if we don't stand strong now, everybody fails. So can you talk about these long-time workers like Lynn? You know, how are they treated in terms of pay and benefits?
Well, I mean, they're, you know, there's a two-tier system in place, so workers like Lynn have much better benefits than younger workers. And you know, they're trying to eliminate that two-tier system. That keeps younger workers capped at something. And this type of strike is bringing together older workers and younger workers that the company often tries to pit against one another.
What else are you hearing from other workers? I mean, as the strike continues, what is their main message here?
Well, I think the main message is that they want respect on the job and they want a sense of power. What's also very interesting is I have a story coming out. I've talked to several workers at non-union Southern auto plants, and this has really helped their organizing efforts because it's making the UAW look like they can go out and fight for something, and that's powerful.
You also reported, and this has gotten a lot of attention, about GM workers losing their health care when they went on strike. This was a very unexpected decision. In previous strikes, you report that GM has never done this, but they're playing hardball now. What is the result of this? Because you write that in Parma, Ohio, one member's child couldn't get cancer treatment as a result of these tactics.
Well, typically what GM had done is they would wait till the end of the month, which is what the UAW expected them to do, and then the health insurance would expire at the end of the month. And the UAW was prepared to pick up Cobra. But the UAW suddenly, and I mean the GM suddenly and unexpectedly decided to cancel the health insurance, and now the UAW is struggling, scrambling to figure out with no notice how to pick up the Cobra. I mean, they have the money to do it, but these things, there's still, you know, there's a glitch before these things pick up. So it's really affecting people. It's causing a lot of stress. People have been denied treatment for cancer. One woman in Nashville woke up from surgery on her stomach to discover that she had no health insurance and owed the hospital $40,000.
Wow.
So this is creating really deep havoc in people's lives. And sure, retroactively it may be picked up, but if you're denied care or you're scared to go to the hospital now, that's still rough.
Well, what is, have there been, I know that there's negotiations going on, but have there been conversations between high-level executives and workers? For example, Mary Barra, how long has she been in the CEO role at General Motors, and what can you tell us about her?
Well, Mary Barra, you know, has been there for a while. Obviously, she's been having these secret meetings with Trump, according to Debbie Dingell, the congresswoman from the Detroit area. And, you know, she's very despised by a lot of workers. Because of some of the decisions. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see where things go.
Hmm. You also cite, you wrote a piece about the New York Times citing Payday Report. And we should say that Payday Report is a very independent labor reporting outlet. It seems like, Mike, I follow you on social media, and whenever there's a strike, you try to raise money to fly to a city to cover this, to do really good on-the-ground grassroots reporting. And the New York Times' David Leonhardt had an op-ed called Why I Am Rooting for the GM Strikers, and he cited your work in this piece.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's interesting, you know, the same thing happened. You know, I've tried to talk news organizations into saying, hey, look, the West Virginia teacher strike is going to be a big deal. Mm-hmm. And I struggled and I struggled and I struggled, and then it was a big deal. Newsrooms aren't set up to cover these kind of stories, and that's a shame. They don't see covering workers as a priority. They don't come from the working class. They don't understand the working class, and it's problematic. It's getting better in some circles, but it's still a long way to go. And so what happened, I was illegally fired during the union drive at Politico, and I won $70,000 as a settlement, but I couldn't find any work. So someone suggested I should start my own site and just see what kind of money I could crowdfund and just, you know, do that while trying to freelance, because I couldn't even find enough work as a freelancer to make a living. So I did that, and, you know, our first year in business, we raised $35,000, so I kept doing it. I kept going. I kept pushing. And then, you know, this year we're on track to raise $50,000, and we've raised about $2,300 to cover this trip, you know, all over the U.S. We started in Rochester, New York. We went to Cleveland, Ohio, and now we're down in Spring Hill, Tennessee, and tomorrow we're going to Bowling Green, Kentucky, then up to Cincinnati and back to Cleveland.
Wow.
So we've been all over, and, you know, we can do things other publications can't because we're funded by workers. And so if people want to support us, then go to paydayreport.com. Again, paydayreport.com and support us. That'd be great.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us. You talked about the piece that you're writing now. What's next in the coming weeks? What do you expect?
Well, we'll see where the strike goes. There's been some progress at the bargaining table. It looks like they're dug in for a little bit. It wouldn't surprise me if the strike went another week, but it's not clear.
Mike Elk is a labor reporter. He writes for The Guardian and paydayreport.com. It is a basically, you can call it a very independent grassroots labor website at a time when there are so few labor reporters working in the national media. Mike, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your reporting.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks to Andrew Stelzer for producing today's show, and thank you for joining us. You can find more information about the show, listen to past shows, and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for line producing today and David Latulip, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.